Prepared for the Kansas State University Great Plains Radio Symposium, held in Manhattan, Kansas, April 28, 2006. Allow me to introduce myself. I'm Richard W. Fatherly, a 1940 war baby from Darien, Connecticut. I was raised there in a mild-mannered Republican home and attended its public schools. I briefly attended Emerson College in Boston, choosing to leave after the first semester to pursue a career in radio broadcasting. My first job at WSTC in Stamford, Connecticut, paid $60 a week. In 1959, a livable wage for a single young man my age. My second job paid $90 per week, beginning in March of 1960, as a street beat reporter, news writer and reader, and weekend top 40 DJ at WNHC in New Haven, Connecticut, for Walter Annenberg's Triangle Publications. Subsequent assignments included New York City and WABC as a radio director. I was paid $125 a week to bring commercial transcriptions to the originating studio for the engineer to play, and to certify that they had been broadcast as scheduled. I would return the transcriptions to WABC's traffic department and bring another set to the next originating studio. I was later hired as the evening disc jockey at WICC in Bridgeport, Connecticut, at $135 per week, and later recruited by WDEE in New Haven, Connecticut, as news director and program director until March 64. WDEE, those call letters moved to Detroit some years later. I was recruited in 1964 by the Storrs Broadcasting Company to become director of production at their KXOK in St. Louis, effectively doubling my income. I took the job and reported to work late in April to witness the construction of the Gateway Arch. No sooner had I accepted the job, the bad news moved on the UPI wire service. Todd Storrs, president of the Storrs Broadcasting Company and the creator of the Top 40 radio format, died April 13th at age 39. UPI said he died from a stroke, a cerebral occlusion. A memo was quick in coming. My job, it said, was secure. The station would stay their course. And, contrary to industry rumor, the Storrs radio stations were not for sale. I remained at KXOK for 3.5 years, then transferred to the Storrs radio flagship, WHB in Kansas City, as its program director, leaving the company late in 1968. During these nearly 5 years, I learned the tactics and strategies of organizing and executing successful radio station programming, hammered out in the 1950s in Omaha. Tried, tested, and refined, and used successfully with each additional radio station acquired by Storrs Radio. By the early 1960s, it became one of the most listened-to radio groups in the history of independent radio in the United States, and piled up revenues in excess of $20 million annually at the height of its popularity into the late 1960s. Now, a post-World War II retrospective. After a bumpy campaign for his 1948 election to the presidency, a million eyes in the nation's capital watched Harry Truman's January 20, 1949 inauguration as hundreds of aircraft in formation buzzed overhead. During Truman's 7 years and 283 days as America's 33rd president, dramatic changes influenced American government, politics, business and industry, mass communications, religion, education, and technology. Truman was America's first Great Plains president. Propellers became jets, black and white turned to color. Crackling 78 RPM records became hi-fi 45 RPM singles and 33 RPM albums. Television arrived, and scientists busied themselves assembling and later detonating a hydrogen bomb under the administration of Dwight D. Eisenhower, America's second Great Plains president. Meanwhile, network television moguls searched for Anglo-profiled authority figures to anchor their debut evening network TV news programs. In 1948, CBS had discovered Oklahoma Great Plainsman Clyde Douglas Edwards. Douglas Edwards would become CBS TV's first network anchor. NBC found their man in John Cameron Swayze, a Wichita, Kansas native who began his media career after attending the University of Kansas and Dramatic School in New York City. He became a reporter and feature editor of the Kansas City, Missouri Journal-Post. Swayze later moved to the news staff of KMBC and WHB in Kansas City, then on to NBC in Hollywood, and to NBC in New York City as anchor of its nightly Camel News Caravan, holding on to that spot from 1949 to 1956. Other radio refugees auditioned for fame and fortune by reading news copy in front of a TV camera. With the invention of the teleprompter, almost anyone with a trained voice and some makeup might appear so intelligent. The world was rapidly changing. The politics of fear often gripped the airwaves. Americans who tuned in to hear nasty network radio gossip Walter Winchell would not soon forget his October 9, 1949 broadcast. Said Winchell, quote, "There's a phony melodrama now being enacted in the nation's capital titled, 'How Did the Russians Discover Our So-Called A-Bomb Secrets?'" Winchell continued, "The so-called secrets, ladies and gentlemen, on how to make an atomic bomb was on sale at any bookstore in the United States in 1946 for only a dollar and a half. The title of the book? Atomic Energy for Military Purposes. It contains the complete text of the official report, plus statements by the Canadian and British government. The cover of this book described it in these words, 'A general account of the scientific research and technical development that went into making of atomic bombs.' How do you like that?" he said. Winchell's voice was pierced by stabs of his signature sarcasm. Meanwhile, war had been spilling over from China into Korea. Soviet spy-turned-snitch Whitaker Chambers' scary revelations and the startup of the Strategic Air Command gave definition to two new words hatched by the foreign policy establishment: Cold War. As the world watched America, more Americans began watching television. Network radio's most listened-to programs were defecting to television, taking with them scores of its top programming and production people, sales and marketing personnel, technicians, and talent. In Omaha, WOW Radio Morning Show host John Carson packed his bags with gags and left for the West Coast as a TV comedy writer, his first step in becoming America's most celebrated media personality, with 4,000 shows over 30 years, interviewing 23,000 guests. Gone or going from network radio were the likes of Jack Benny, Our Miss Brooks, Dragnet, Superman, The Lone Ranger, Sky King, Gunsmoke, and many others, and a laundry list of soap operas. With them to the new glamour medium went most of their advertisers. Television was hot, and getting hotter. By 1949, 97 television station construction permits had been issued by the Federal Communications Commission, followed by a freeze on new permits. This would give TV networks, namely NBC, time to line up their choice of the very high, or VHF, frequencies, channels 2 through 13, for their important big city affiliates. The freeze was lifted July 1, 1952, and provided 2,053 TV channels in 1,291 cities, 617 VHF, and 1,436 UHF construction permits were up for grabs. By 1960, the FCC had issued some 650 TV construction permits, with more on the way, while TV headhunters had been scouting the radio networks for their top people in sales, marketing, management, and production. Likewise, local advertisers and their advertising agencies were being switch-pitched by aggressive television sales and marketing teams to move their radio and print budgets to television. Along Main Street, USA, stood hundreds of locals on downtown sidewalks, looking into appliance and department store windows at spellbinding displays of TV sets in use. As television was invading the American home, it had been working unsuccessfully to empty local radio stations of their advertising revenues. It was network radio that was going to the ropes. From 1945 to 1961, network radio revenues declined from $134 million to their historic low of $44.9 million, according to the Radio Advertising Bureau. But local radio was in relatively good shape. The Federal Communications Commission had authorized more than 1,500 new AM radio construction permits from 1950 to 1960, increasing by 75% the number of AM signals in the United States from 2,086 to 3,632. From 1950 to 1955, local radio revenues grew from $203.2 million to $272 million. In 1960, they jumped to $401.6 million. Record revenues occurred in 1968, when local and non-network national spot advertising revenues first reached $1.130 billion during the administration of Lyndon B. Johnson, America's third Great Plains president. According to a 1958 study titled The Dynamic Change in Radio, prepared by Adam Young Incorporated, a national advertising sales representative for radio stations in the top 25 markets, the growth of local independent radio over the network affiliate was, quote, no longer a trend. It's an accomplished fact, unquote. The Young Report observed that until 1952, the most listened to radio stations in the top 25 markets had been network affiliates. By 1957, the leading radio stations in 21 of the top 25 markets were now independents, a ratio of 21 to 4. How this happened is a fascinating story. Media-driven trends in the United States usually implode into the Great Plains from the two coasts. Beginning in 1951, however, a non-network radio programming trend exploded in the Great Plains, in Omaha, moved to New Orleans in 1953, and was perfected in Kansas City and copied from coast to coast. It began with the creation of the Mid-Continent Broadcasting Company. It was at daytime-only KOWH AM 660 in Omaha that radio stunt-minded strategies were born, as early as 1950, propelling daytime-only KOWH into the national spotlight in 1951 as America's top-rated independent radio station, earning a 1951 citation from Nebraska Governor Val Peterson, recognizing KOWH as, quote, America's most listened-to independent station, unquote, based on telephonic Hooper ratings. KOWH began using Hooper ratings in October of 1951 and maintained its relationship with Hooper well into the 1960s. One way to inflate a first week of the month Hooper rating was to schedule a listen-to-win station promotion, which we did religiously. I recall the last one we did as program director at WHB with the Win-A-Car Bonanza. We gave away 9 brand-new automobiles. Concurrent with Hooper, stores later used the Pulse Incorporated, and beginning in 1967, the Arbitron ratings, with its diary sampling method. Ratings information provided listening estimates, from which our advertising rates were determined. Stores radio didn't sell time, spots, or advertising. Stores radio sold audience, lots of audience, at a fair price, at a low cost per thousand impressions. You see, Todd made a promise to KOWH advertisers in the KOWH brochure titled What Makes KOWH Tick, circa 1952. In it, he said, the one sure way for us to keep your business on KOWH is to give you results, and results within a reasonable price range. We know of only one way to get results, said Todd. That is to have an audience in large enough numbers for every one of your commercials and programs. Just as the regular salesman on the street, your radio salesman must make calls to get results. Therefore, said Todd, we pledge to you, our advertisers, that every program policy will be geared to obtain a bigger volume of listeners to KOWH and to your commercial message, unquote. By 1952, KOWH's razzle-dazzle programming featured popular music described as best-selling recordings and a recording librarian well up on what folks like to hear, hourly news at 5 minutes before the hour, happy talk disc jockeys, listen-to-win contests and games, and controversial outside stunts. It was at KOWH in Omaha where many of Storr's earliest ideas were tried and successfully tested, including varying degrees of media mischief inspired by Todd and executed by his capable staff. Briefly, October 1951. KOWH hid money at various locations in Omaha and Council Bluffs, Iowa, broadcasting clues leading to its whereabouts. There were huge traffic jams. Todd was arrested while scouting the results of the promotion for his failure to stay in the line of traffic as police tried to redirect it. He was released on $10 bond. As Todd had intended, the publicity became the talk of the town. Todd's treasure hunts were only the beginning of KOWH's ascendancy. Remember, we're talking about a daytime-only radio station with a sunrise-to-sunset broadcast schedule, once owned by the enormously influential Omaha World Herald newspaper, and purchased in 1949 by Todd and his father Robert for $75,000. March 1952, KOWH announcer James O'Neill tossed cash from atop a tree to gathering crowds in downtown Omaha. Traffic was tied up for blocks. O'Neill was arrested, forfeited bond, and KOWH listeners were urged to go to the police station to bail him out because the station said he didn't have enough money. On a sunny day in April of 1953, KOWH rebroadcast for a full day its previous year's emergency announcements recorded from its Missouri River flood threat coverage. During the rebroadcasts, dozens of people showed up at City Hall to volunteer. The local Nurses Association wanted to know why they hadn't been notified. The mayor received countless calls, and many people left their jobs to return home expecting the worst. Meanwhile, phone lines to local authorities were jammed. KOWH offered this reason for the scary repeat broadcasts. Quote, to keep people awake to the ever-present threat of an emergency, end quote. This next stunt takes a prize for its audacity. In June of 1953, KOWH newsman Don Loughnane slipped into several nightclubs with a hidden wire recorder equipped with a Dick Tracy wristwatch microphone to catch comments from some of Omaha's noteworthy establishmentarians as they participated in illegal gambling at these after-hours night spots. Some of the recorded comments were broadcast. Most were not, because Todd said they were too hot. The excuse for still another stunt takes the cake. KOWH placed checks in selected books at the Omaha Public Library to, quote, encourage better patronage of the library, unquote. It caused a run on its otherwise quiet and studied reading rooms. Some 90 volumes were damaged or destroyed. KOWH paid $565 in damages. Now, today's hip promoters would probably refer to Todd Storr's ideas as thinking outside of the box. More cautious observers would call it audacity, intrepidity. In any case, Storr's style media mischief grabbed the attention of the wire services, local newspapers, and in some cases television, causing the public to tune to 660 on the dial to hear for themselves what was going on KOWH. When they got there, they were now inside the box, with listen-to-win cash and merchandise promotions, including lucky house number, lucky license number, news tip cash awards, play radio, and many more. Now, Omaha had a radio station with a lot to listen for, rather than just listen to. Storrs called it the new KOWH. In 1953, Storrs purchased WTIX in New Orleans. Like KOWH, it became the new WTIX, with the same bill of fare and one extraordinary exception. To counter-program an NBC affiliate, WTIX covered WDSU AM's 1280 countdown of the top 20 records of the day in between soap operas. Here's what WTIX did. They added 20 additional song titles from Billboard, Cashbox, and their own local retail store and jukebox research. Then WTIX started its countdown an hour earlier and finished an hour later. WDSU's top 20 on 1280 was smothered by WTIX's top 40 on 1450. Speaking in Kansas City on June 11, 2004, former KOWH disc jockey and WTIX program director Bill Armstrong explained Top 40's true origins.
But it was at WTIX that a really significant event occurred, because it was the birth of the Top 40. It happened just a little before I got there, but because I was at WTIX and because I was the only teenage Top 40 disc jockey, nothing to do with me, it was just an accident. Well, how did it happen? And it's important we don't let this get lost in the mists of time and history. On WDSU, there was an announcer who had a popular radio program in the afternoon where he presented the Top 20. Well, Bud Armstrong and Todd Storrs knew a good thing when they saw it. And I don't know whether it was Bud, I think it was, or Todd, or the two of them together, said, "We're going to be twice as good as that. We're going to present the Top 40. And so from that point on, every day on WTIX, or as we used to call it, the new WTIX, we presented in order number 40, number 39, all the way up to number 1. And that, friends, is where the Top 40 was born.
George W. Armstrong, not related to William L. Armstrong, took the Top 40 idea with him to Kansas City in 1954, immediately following the purchase of WHB. Interviewed by Kansas City Star reporter Brian Burns in 1987, George Armstrong, who transferred from the new WTIX as general manager of the new WHB, said this: "Top 40 was not a blinding revelation in a bar. A format of playing popular hits, discerned through research and surveys and record store sales, was refined in Omaha over 2 years. It was only after stores acquired a second station, WTIX in New Orleans, that the format found a name. We called it Top 40, and when we brought it to WHB, we stuck it in." It was a week or two later, he estimates, when Kansas City first heard an afternoon Top 40 show that counted down the popular hits in reverse order. George Armstrong took a more assertive stance with Brian Williams of the University of Maryland at College Park. During a July 15, 1996 interview in Omaha, George Armstrong said,
"There's an old myth, which is totally false, and I want to dispel it right off the bat. An old story that went around, I don't know who fabricated it, but it was a total fabrication that somehow Todd and I or whoever went to a bar one night and heard that the jukeboxes were playing more of some records than others, and then this great inspiration was spawned to do the kind of format we were doing. That's totally untrue. We were already doing it. Number one. Number two, jukebox operators were brought in more to try to balance what we were getting from the record stores than anything else. Sure, any fool that ever went to a bar knew that some records were played more often than others, and there was no great inspiration or in that. I mean, we knew that going in. And so the myth of this being some kind of a revelation is not true, never was true. And I didn't hear it myself until, I never heard the story myself until 15 years later, when somebody, I think, probably was peddling to make a name for themselves or something.
Armstrong said KOWH surveyed jukebox plays not as a survey factor, but as a reference to see if Omaha was tracking with the rest of the country, as measured by weekly music trade publications. As early as 1950, the evolution of the KOWH revolution began to focus on the spaced repetition of the nation's top 10 current hits, mixed with pop standards from the KOWH music library. Todd took the top 10 cue from the long-running Saturday Night Network program, Your Hit Parade. Beginning in 1935, it featured a one-hour playback of the nation's top 15 current hits in reverse order performed by network musicians and vocalists. In 1951, Your Hit Parade was reduced to a half hour and featured the top 10 in reverse order, still introduced by veteran announcer Andre Baruch. It was America's Saturday night listening treat, sponsored by Lucky Strike. Its producers allege that its research was infallible and was based primarily on readings of radio requests, sheet music sales, requests to orchestra leaders around the country, and jukebox tabulations, according to CBS Radio, quoting John Dunning's Tune In Yesterday, published in 1976 by Prentice Hall. KOWH music research was similar in some respects, but took it to another level. Telephone requests. While KOWH was quick to play the original recordings of the same top 10 hits broadcast on Your Hit Parade, resulting in an upward nudge of KOWH's Hooper ratings, Todd's decision to hire KBON Requests and Dedications music personality Sandy Jackson put KOWH on top in the ratings. By 1951, its playlist of current hits was gradually expanded to some 20 record titles, still interspersed with selections from its library of pop standards. The ratings likewise increased, with KOWH's Paging the Stars, hosted by James O'Neill, and the program Sweet Music, with George Armstrong, then KOWH's music librarian. KOWH, a daytime-only station, had become the nation's most listened-to independent. The term Top 40 was never used at KOWH until 1956. It was first used at WTIX late in 1953 and found a home on WHB in Kansas City, where it became, quote, effective October 18, 1954, unquote, according to its official program guide provided to its national station representatives, the John Blair Company. The term Top 40 found its way into Houghton Mifflin Company's American Heritage College Dictionary, 4th edition. On page 1450, we quote, with the kind permission of the publisher, Top 40, a plural noun. The 40 most popular music recordings of songs of a given time period. As an adjective, relating to, made up of, or broadcasting, the top 40. It cannot be ignored. Top 40 is part of the second half of the 20th century American heritage, and its origins began with the Mid-Continent Broadcasting Company, headquartered in Omaha, Nebraska, late in 1953. At WTIX, AM 1450, in New Orleans, Louisiana, under the management of George W. Armstrong. Limited to 250 watts at 1450 on the dial, its signal strength barely covered the city. Despite the disadvantage, WTIX soon became the dominant daytime station and number two at night. By 1958, stores had negotiated the purchase of WWEZ AM 690 and gifted 1450 on the dial to the New Orleans School Board for use as an educational station, moving the WTIX call letters to 690 with 5,000 watts. A power upgrade put its daytime power at 10,000 watts. The new WTIX, as they would call it, would blanket the Gulf Coast with Top 40 programming. Todd's decision to broadcast KOWH News at 5 minutes before the hour provided breakout coverage 5 minutes earlier than his competition. KOWH News Live at 55 not only scooped the other Omaha radio stations, it allowed him to begin his music menu at the top of the hour, when other Omaha outlets were broadcasting news. In 1958, ABC News took Live at 55 as its network news theme. KOWH News content was, no doubt, of particular interest to the personnel stationed at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, world headquarters for the Strategic Air Command, or SAC, under General Curtis E. LeMay. On-base personnel were armed. It was a haven for top-secret clearances and the operations center for high-flying aircraft carrying atomic bombs. And SAC had a huge payroll. good business for Storrs Beer. Generally, May had been the tactical brains of the 8th Air Force over Germany during World War II. He was to the air war over Germany what General George S. Patton had been on the ground during the liberation of Germany from the Nazi war machine. Moving to the Pacific and the Mariana Islands at Tinian, LeMay brought the big, new, shiny B-29 superforts into the Pacific War against the Japanese, with low-altitude fire bombings, and the atomic bombings of Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, and Nagasaki on August 9, 1945. LeMay's credentials to boss the Strategic Air Command demanded Omaha's full attention. Like Todd, LeMay was, himself, a ham radio operator. Several years after World War II, LeMay's personal chef, Gunter Pollack, was imported to Omaha from Wiesbaden, Germany, by Arthur C. Storrs Sr., then vice president of the Storrs Brewing Company. Like Pollack, Gottlieb Storrs, Arthur's father, was brought to Omaha from Germany by German brewmaster Joseph F. Baumann, who started Omaha's early Columbia Brewery in 1863. Immediately prior to Baumann's death, his widow ran the brewery in 1884, the year she sold it to Gottlieb and 1 J.D. Eiler. Gottlieb later went into business for himself as head of the Storrs Brewing Company at 1807 North 16th Street. The Todd Storrs story begins with his grandparents, Gottlieb and Mina Buck Storrs, and their six children, Adolf, Louis, Arthur Sr., Robert, and sisters Minnie and Olga. Kid brother Robert Herman Storrs, was Todd's father. His mother was Mildred Todd Storrs. They had two children, Robert Todd Storrs and the younger Susan Storrs, Todd's sister. Todd was born May 8, 1924, and attended Omaha Public Schools. He was not a particularly good student, but at the age of 8 demonstrated a fascination with radio, building a crystal radio receiver from scratch. In his early teen years, Todd became acquainted with one Dale Mowdy from Kearney, Nebraska. As friends and 5-meter bootleggers, they played ham radio without a license. By 16, Todd was a licensed ham radio operator under the call W9DYG. After the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, ham radio operators were ordered off the air until further notice. The late Edward B. Ted Ayers, former alumni director of the Choate School, now Choate Rosemary Hall at Wallingford, Connecticut, remembered Todd. "Todd was not one of our best students, because his tremendous love for radio conflicted with his studies," Ayers said. He noted that Todd didn't particularly want to compete in a varsity sport, nor actually was he big enough. The Choate 1942 class yearbook put Todd at 5'8" tall and 130 pounds at age 18. His physics professor, H. Dayton Niehaus, wrote, "Todd is planning to pursue a course in business administration at the University of Nebraska. Unless he gets in the Army or Navy service, he will not go beyond the amateur status in the radio world. I expect he will always have it as a hobby and will develop himself in it as he finds time to do more work." That, perhaps, is the understatement of the century. Following Todd's 1942 graduation from Choate, Robert H. Storrs wrote to the school, saying in part, "His radio work has proven not only valuable to him, but to his country. He has attended several schools, the most important being the Cryptographer School in the Signal Corps. He passed with the highest score of anyone applying for the warrant officer appointment." Todd's yearbook picture bears the caption, "For such as we are made of, such are we." Todd was known to his fellow students as Hot Toddy, T.D., Todd, and Sparks. Todd's history professor, Russell Ayers, summed up Todd's year-end class project on Elm Haven slum clearance in New Haven, Connecticut, saying in part, "Here, Todd made inquiries, drew diagrams, took pictures, and then organized his findings into a radio sketch, which he recorded on two records. Todd played these to all my classes, and we enjoyed them and profited by them. Todd has not neglected his more routine work, for his 70 on the final exam shows a well-planned interview. I know nothing about the University of Nebraska where Todd is planning to attend, but I do know that Todd can make his stay there worthwhile if he wants to. I may be wrong, but I somehow sense a great man in the making. Generally, each of the store's stations operated manually and independently with their own business forms and procedures, which included control over all money transactions with separate bank accounts for each station. After Todd's passing in 1964, all of that would change. The Miami Beach home office operations returned to Omaha. By 1966, all invoicing, payrolls, disbursements, cash receipts, and authorization for capital purchases were supervised by Controller John Johnson, hired by Robert H. Storrs to centralize its business operations, supported by mainframe data processing and later by computer disk. Storrs Executive Vice President George W. Armstrong left his post as General Manager of WHB in Kansas City to manage the day-to-day operations of the Storrs stations from Omaha. Following the 1957 sale of KOWH AM 660 in Omaha to William F. Buckley's National News Weekly, Incorporated, the six Storrs stations included WTIX New Orleans, WHB Kansas City, WDGY Minneapolis-St. Paul, WQAM Miami, KOMA Oklahoma City, and KXOK St. Louis. Beginning in 1978, they were each sold on a station-by-station basis, the last being KXOK in 1985. Robert H. Storrs died in 1992 at the age of 93. His wife Mildred had predeceased him at the age of 87, bringing to a close an important chapter in American radio history.